Something coming faster than any of us can imagine and will change our lives in the most dramatic ways is AI.
And while AI used to sound freaky to me and just something that was going to take over my world, it really would have revolutionized my practice had I stuck around. Many of you know, I got so burnt out from charting. It was the big reason I left medicine because I was frustrated with the EMRs, the clunkiness, and the amount of time it took to learn them. Not only that, but not being able to sit and connect with a patient and look them in the eye, like one-on-one while you're actually interacting with them, the whole reason we went into medicine, not to do paperwork.
Yeah, so that's why May and I have started working with Lindy.ai, which is fascinating. They help you produce the most efficient notes, fully customizable, which is different than some other AI products, so you can do what you do best, which is see patients and let the artificial intelligence scribe do the dirty work for you.
Yeah, not only do you get the perfect patient notes the way you want, written in any format, for whatever specialty you're in, and maybe you're in ophthalmology or vet medicine, it will also create the note, scribe and send the patient follow-up instructions, referral letters, consultation notes. It's amazing. Lindy is offering our listeners a 7-day trial to experience the difference of their AI medical scribe. Go sign up at lindy.ai/bsfree to get started. That is Lindy, lindy.ai/bsfree.
Finally, a source of raw, real, and honest information on healthcare issues that matter most. Welcome to BS Free MD. From the latest medical information to how to stay sane as a doctor or a patient, no subject is taboo, no BS is allowed. Now, let's welcome your hosts, Drs. May and Tim Hindmarsh.
Hey everybody, welcome back to BS Free MD. Today's interview is a follow-up interview with Dr. Stephanie Pearson. And last time we chatted with her, her story really stuck with us and the listeners as well. So from her days as an OB-GYN to her pivot into the world of into the world of insurance and disability advocacy after a life-changing injury, Stephanie's journey is nothing short of remarkable. But there is more to her story and what she's doing. And today we're diving back in to talk to her about the bigger picture, the twists and turns of the healthcare system, the insurance maze, and how she's standing up for doctors everywhere. And so let's get into it and uncover the insights that could change the way we think about the safety nets in place for us in healthcare. Hello, Stephanie. Welcome back. We're happy to have you and chat some more.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me back.
So the last time you were on, you know, you highlighted like what happened in your career and your story. And it's like total testament to the importance of having disability insurance. For those that haven't listened, is there a 10-minute Sparks Notes version that you can share of what happened to you?
I think I could do like a 2 or 3 minute. Basically, I'm an OBGYN by training, and unfortunately, I got kicked in the shoulder during a difficult patient delivery, and she ruined my shoulder and my career. I started with a torn labrum. I was not given great advice from my first orthopedist. I developed a frozen shoulder, had a new doc who said, no problem, we'll operate and get you back in 12 weeks. And I woke up with him sitting at the edge of my bed telling me that it looked like a bomb had gone off in my shoulder and that I was not getting cleared to do OB or operate. And then unbeknownst to me, my contract in fine print said I needed to be able to do 100% of my job. And so I was unceremoniously terminated the day my FMLA was up. And that was coming after having been asked to be our chairperson before I left. So I learned a lot the hard way about disability and life insurance and really took my experiences, my journey, my mistakes, and started a company, realizing that I had not been educated appropriately in the insurance space. I had not been advocated for in a way that I felt good about, and honestly felt like I couldn't have been the only physician that was in this place or had been in this place or might be in that place in the future. And without sounding terribly trite, God bless you, I wanted to change the way that it was done. And so here I am. The company will be 7 years old in June. And my bigger why really is around education. I consider us educators first and foremost instead of salespeople.
Well, and I think that's where it all lies. You know, as May and I have discussed, and we have had several financially based interviews, this whole concept of how unbelievably well-trained you can be as a physician. You can be, you know, 12 years out of high school to before you start working, and how unbelievably financially ignorant most doctors are. Excuse me.
Right. Absolutely.
I'm fighting the Black Plague of Venice, Florida.
You can keep it.
I hope you feel better.
No, I mean, feel okay. I just cough.
Listen, you know, I say it all the time. We're taught how to be good physicians. We are not taught how to be successful adults. And unless you had financially savvy parents or somebody told you to take a financial class in undergrad, it's just stuff we don't know. It's baseline ignorance. It's not, I can't think of the word. Sorry, menopause is real. But
it's all right. To your point, it's like not even just the physicians. Most people, you know, depending on their track that they do in college or whatever training that they get, you don't get a lot of that stuff in high school. If your parents haven't taught you, or if they haven't been financially savvy, you're supposed to just, I don't know, absorb it from the ethos. And unless you have like a business degree in finance marketing, people are just clued out. And if you have no interest in it, then you're in a big world of hurt, right? Because it's like, eh.
We are highly trained, hopefully above average intelligence. And like you said, even in primary care, you know, quite a bit above baseline as far as average income, but largely financially ignorant, which means you can get picked off by all sorts of schemes really easily, and why it's really important to understand basic financial planning, which obviously includes insurance as a large pillar in that, just like wills and trusts and all this stuff. But yet, I think it's really simple. Like, financial planning is not hard. It's really simple. There's just certain principles that you have to be in, and none of them are get rich quick schemes. They're all get rich slow schemes. And if you do it right, they all work.
Right. And one of the shortcomings that I have seen, and it again, no fault of our own, we want our patients to trust us, right? So I have found as a whole, and I'm painting with a very wide brush, that physicians are over-trusting. So, you know, you have people out there who may be less than totally ethical or are driven by financial gain instead of education. And we inherently trust them because that's what we want. And I can say for myself, I was not educated appropriately. I was not advocated for appropriately. I trusted somebody because my senior partner said, I have a guy.
Yeah.
Right.
That sounds very familiar.
And I didn't know the questions to ask. I didn't know what I didn't know. And I was trusting that this gentleman had my best interest at hand. And in fact, he had his own best interest.
Of course.
At hand. Right.
Especially if they're selling policies and making money.
Correct.
So the trust thing and being very naive is definitely a trait. So what are some other common misconceptions or gaps in like things we should know and shouldn't as far as insurance? Like, do you have how long is the list?
Yeah, I was going to say the list is as long as my arm. I think some overarching issues have to do with the difference between a group disability policy and an individual disability policy. I find not infrequently that folks think that because their employer offers them a benefit that they're protected. And oftentimes it's one line on your open enrollment packet, you check a box, right? They don't even have to give you the policy. They don't have to tell you anything about it. And, you know, oftentimes people won't realize that the benefit is a taxable benefit.
Wow.
If your group benefit is paid for by your employer, it's taxable. So big difference between taxable money and tax-free money.
Interesting.
Yep. Secondly, has to do with what limitations are in a group disability policy. Oftentimes, it's a percentage of your base, and I'll come back to that in a second, up to a maximum benefit. And oftentimes, I'll hear, oh, 60% of my income is covered. And then I get to be in this unenviable position of saying, well, it's 60% of your base income, and look at how your salary and compensation is delineated.
Yes.
And oh, by the way, it has a maximum benefit of $5,000 a month, which may not even be 60% of your base, right? And so it's a big one, right? That's a big pill to swallow. Oftentimes, the language is misleading. There's no standardization of language in insurance. And so these group policies will say that they're own occupation, but they're not. The way that it gets defined is what's called held by the national economy and the local labor market. It is not specific to what one employee does at one employer site. Mm. What that allows the companies to do is cast this really wide net that says this is what you would, could, should be able to do based on your training, education, and skill set. Oftentimes, the way that they define total disability is misleading. It might be that it's you can't do your job, but then they add and not be gainfully employed. Most type A people in medicine are not hardwired to be stay-at-homes. And I will tell you, I have the utmost respect for stay-at-home parents. I am not one. I used to say the old adage, I'd give my left arm to be home with my boys more. Turns out I gave my left arm to be home with my boys more, who were 4 and 6 at the time. And after about 6 weeks, I wanted to kill everybody. You know, you don't want to have to worry about losing part or all of your benefit while you're trying to figure out what your next chapter is. And with private policies, they can be truly specialty specific. The word "and" gets changed to "regardless" in the definition of total disability. One word makes a huge difference. You're considered totally disabled if you can't do your job, regardless if you're gainfully employed in another occupation. So as long as I am not able to be an OBGYN, I'm getting paid. And that's what you want as a physician, right? I mean, you spend your entire life getting to a certain point, and if that's taken away, you want to be protected. And so I'd say that that's a big one. I think also in the life insurance arena, if you haven't been taught, this is my humble opinion, young physicians who are starting families don't need permanent life insurance. There's term and permanent. Permanent is an umbrella. It encompasses whole, universal, variable, and indexed. They're super expensive. And most young people don't need a definitive death benefit of millions, right? Our most financially burdensome time is raising children, presumably right, getting them out of the house and educated. Once they've eclipsed that period, most of us don't need millions in coverage. Term is cheap, it's easy, it's there when you need it the most, right? But if nobody teaches you this, you get these folks who come in and try to sell it like it's an investment vehicle. By the way, do not mix insurance and investing. That's not the way to go. You know, or they try to tout it that it builds cash value, you can borrow against it. That's not why you should be buying it. And I'll say I'm not totally against it. I think that there's a time and a place for it. It's just not when you're starting out, right? So that's another one. And then I would say also kind of outside of my expertise, one of the things that I just hear a lot about is malpractice insurance, right? So people don't really understand the difference between claims made and occurrence made. People don't necessarily think about, is there a tail? Is there not a tail? And for certain of us who are in highly litigious fields, mm-hmm. tails are like, if you don't have a tail, you need to negotiate for a tail. I've seen people in very toxic environments feel stuck because they know that if they leave, they're going to have to purchase their own, which, by the way, is protection later. So if you change jobs and you're somewhere new, it still protects you from whence you came, so that if a claim comes, you know, years later, you're still covered. And I can tell you in OBGYN, I've seen people have to pay up to six figures to purchase their own tail. And so while I'm not a contract person, I think it's really important for young physicians getting their first, you know, even second attending jobs. It's worth a couple $100 to have somebody look over your contract who that's what they do for a living and make sure that you're tight.
Wow. Yes.
Well, and make sure that they understand physician contracts.
Yes.
Because you could be like the smartest contract lawyer in the world. And if you've never worked with docs, the tail coverage means nothing. Well, tail coverage, especially if you're a proceduralist, any of the surgical specialties, that's massive. Yeah. Like for us, tail's not that much because,
right,
you know, we've done primary care and urgent care. It's low acuity for the most part.
Right.
You know, your overall risk is reasonably low. I mean, it might be two or 3,000. It might be 5,000 at the most, depending on what state you live mm-hmm. in. You know, it's not that big of a deal.
And I got to jump in because I know my girlfriend's listening and she's like, what the hell? Purchase a tail. What are you guys into now? But yes, tail coverage, a tail is basically insurance to after the fact, after you've left that job. It usually covers you for 3 years for any litigation that happened while you were working at that other place. So there you go. Malpractice insurance after you're gone. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Not a tail that you wear.
I mean, depending on who you ask. But
there you go. Well, nowadays, everything goes. People are like, what are they talking about?
Yeah. So
no, and I never realized it could be so expensive in certain.
Oh, my God.
It makes sense, right? And then in certain states.
Yes.
Right. I mean, I'm in Pennsylvania, and I was a practicing OBGYN. We have one of the highest payouts on cases.
Wow.
So you need to be protected, and it's really expensive.
Yeah. See, whereas Florida put a cap on.
Yes.
And then they have a pool. They have a damaged at birth
they
pool
have that
you pay
it's called
into.
NECA,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. We don't have that in Pennsylvania.
It's like a mandatory insurance sort of policy. And, you know, first you go to pay and you're like, groaning as you write another check for $500. But honestly,
it's got to be well worth it.
Yeah, exactly.
Because this is not a political talk, but there's got to be more tort reform. I don't know. I don't know how anybody goes into OB anymore. I really don't. And it's a shame because I would probably kill a puppy to be back in the OR. But it's just the litigiousness has just gotten out of hand.
Well, and then, you know, it's the same thing that's happened in all specialties. You've had fragmentation of care.
Right.
So, you know, you have laborists, which is probably, mm-hmm. you know, which, you're an expert in labor. You know, you have people that do just gynecological surgeries and subspecialists that do just gyno-urological surgeries. And that's all fine. The problem is from a litigation perspective, you don't have a relationship with the patient, which is the single greatest malpractice insurance in the world, is the relationship you have with the patient and their family. When you don't have that and something bad happens, your risk is through the roof.
Yeah. I mean, that's,
you know, I delivered, you know, one woman, I delivered all five of her kids, you know, they damn near named one of them after me. You know, it's like, these are real relationships that are protective both ways.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, and look, that's been studied for decades. Yes. I mean, I remember I was in college 25 years ago, or more. Oh God, 30. I'm coming up on my 30th. Oh God. Okay. So, I'm old, but I took a sociology of medicine class, you know, in 1997. And that was one of the lectures was, you know, you can be a terrible doctor, but if people love you, you're not going to get sued. You can be the best doctor in the world, but if you have poor bedside manner or you don't have a relationship with the patient, your risk of getting sued is exponentially higher.
Absolutely. It's all about relationship, trust, and even like to think about it, bad outcome and someone who trusts you, they'll often say, well, you did the best you could. Things happen. This is medicine. Nothing's 100% certain.
Mother nature.
Yeah. Whereas if you're an asshole, then they want someone to blame and you're going to be the first person. Absolutely. Yeah. Even if it, you know, wasn't your fault, it was a risk of whatever procedure. No, it's absolutely true. Let's talk about kind of trends in insurance, where things might be going and what you see. You know, there's a couple avenues I want to take this, but one is any new things that are going to be happening in the insurance field, and then let's talk about health of people in general.
It's a great question. There's a couple of things that I can speak to and a couple of things that I can just guess about, right?
Sure.
There's absolutely been an increase in insurtech and AI being used for underwriting. I think it's okay for life insurance. I don't think it's okay for disability insurance. Disability insurance is so much more nuanced and there are so many more pieces of the puzzle that I still wholeheartedly believe that it's relational and that there needs to be human contact. Mm-hmm. I also have found that in some of our younger generation, they don't really want to talk to a human, right? They want to be able to do everything on their phone. They want to be able to do it through an app. They don't want to get on a phone a call. You know, the insurtech piece, because we are so heavily DI, I don't think that that'll be something that we incorporate. I do think that we'll probably be working on a phone app at some point and a way to get around human conversation. I don't love it, but I think it's going to happen. And then it's just going to make our pre-data collection a little bit more important. So that's one thing. I think that there's always an evolution in the product design. They tend to change about every 3 to 5-ish years based on claims made. So it's not necessarily as devious as it sometimes seems, but at the end of the day, we want these companies to be solvent so they can pay the honest claims that are being made. We all know that there are people out there who, you know, try to beat the system and are fraudulent. Mm-hmm. And they have to do their risk mitigation the same way we do. And I think that for a lot of agents and brokers, kind of like our old school medicine guys, right? You got taught something 10, 12 years ago, and you may not be up to date. I find the same thing happens in this industry that, you know, someone will talk to someone and they're like product designs behind. And so it's really important that people stay up to date on these. Some of the health issues, you know, I am a huge champion of women's health and women-centric coverage. I've been fortunate in being successful in some of my fights against the insurance companies as far as, you know, if somebody's had a C-section or, you know, some other outcome that maybe historically the insurance companies viewed in one light that I've been able to get them to view it in another light. Things like PrEP meds used to really cause a problem. And I fought tirelessly about that and feeling that it was discriminatory. And I've been able to change some of the underwriting guidelines. Some of the newer things that the carriers just don't have enough knowledge about right now is a lot of the new biologics and a lot of the new weight loss drugs.
Interesting.
And unfortunately, we just got to play by their rules, but it's a matter of kind of every couple of months, I'm following up with them to see if things have changed. They just don't have the data, right? So everyone and their brother and mother are on Ozempic. Right. And they're not all for diabetes. It's not actually FDA approved for weight loss. So the insurance companies don't care if that's why you're doing it. They're going to treat you like you're a diabetic. Right. One of the carriers has loosely agreed to just look at BMI. But they also treat weight loss in an interesting way, which I guess makes sense. It just annoys me. They're going to add back half of the weight loss that you've had in the preceding 12 months.
Wow.
Because actuarial data shows that most people gain it back.
Right.
Right. So, you know, we have some companies with these weight loss drugs who are making policies way more expensive, who are cutting back on benefit periods, who, you know, are really doubling down on, we don't know what the risk profile is going to look like 10, 15, 20 years from now, and we need to risk mitigate. I don't see that changing for a while. We just don't have the data.
I was going to say, that's a really good point though, because a lot of people don't think, you know, and if you're in medicine, you should kind of put the pieces together. But I guess I'm thinking for anybody else that's listening, that's not in the medical field specifically, I don't know, dental, PT, pick your, or something completely different. You know, you think, oh yeah, I'm going to take Ozempic for weight loss. Why would it affect me, my ability to get disability or whatever insurance? But you're not knowing exactly what you said, what they're looking at, what it's written for, and you could be screwing yourself big time by just hopping on.
I think Ozempic has a 25% chance of getting pulled by the FDA based on the new claims that are coming. And it's just been used so
randomly.
They're spraying the earth with bullets on this one.
Mm-hmm.
Really, when you look at it from a 30,000 foot view, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It's an 18-year-old drug. It's not an 8-month-old drug. It's an 18-year-old drug. If it was going to cure obesity, we would have known by now. We don't. It was used infrequently, but with consistent use for the last 18 years.
Yeah.
And people lost a little bit of weight. They went off it. They gained it back.
Right.
Well, now they're staying on it. And this gastroparesis stuff, which is already a complication of diabetes.
I was going to bring that up.
I was an insurance company, I'd run away from it.
Right.
Well, that's what I'm saying. And I was going to bring up, you brought up the exact thing. It's the gastroparesis increase. And for people with undiagnosed gastroparesis, it makes it worse. And so, you know, when insurance companies, specifically for disability insurance, when it's looking at morbidity risk, right, they have to take into account what are the side effects of these drugs and what might people go out on claim later, right?
Right.
No, very few people are going out on claim because they're losing weight, right? They're right. Going out on claim because of the side effects that are associated with the medications, which is one of the issues with all the biologics right now.
Right.
You know, I feel like every time you turn on TV, there's a new one and there are real side effects. I mean, God, all you have to do is listen to the commercials, right? I don't know how anyone takes any of these, but admittedly, I started Plaquenil 6.5 weeks ago for something. And, you know, I found out today at the eye doctor that just being on Plaquenil puts me on a whole nother track for my eye exams.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a doc. I had no idea.
Well, and that's an ancient drug.
Right.
Plaquenil is like a 50-year-old drug.
Yeah.
It's been used on, hundreds of millions of prescriptions. It's
totally different.
It's totally different than an immunologic.
Right.
It's truly, like I say, like, I think we need to, this is a little bit of a bunny trail, but we've messed with the immune system a lot.
Yep.
And the immune system is kind of like, we live in Florida. There's ponds, there's gators in the ponds. The reason you don't see the gators is because no one feeds them. When you start frozen, when you start taking frozen chickens and throwing them in there, you'll see lots. And I think we're throwing a lot of frozen chickens into the immune system. Like when you even see these immunologics for end stage, you know, lung cancer. And one of the complications is, you know, Crohn's disease. And you sit there and you go, and it gives you 90 days maximum benefit. And it's like, how can they sell a single prescription of this, let alone make enough money to advertise during Monday Night Football? Yeah, it is staggering.
I have no idea. And I will tell you that it is not infrequent that I get an intake form, because we ask very targeted medical stuff, because again, part of why I do what I do is to manage realistic expectations, and I want to set people up for success. I have to look stuff up. You know, there'll be a medication I haven't heard of, you know, or I don't really know what it does. And how can I expect my other brokers who are not medical people? So I'm cutting and pasting from, you know, happy Google and trying to figure out what are the insurance companies going to think about this? And luckily, right, I have a bunch of underwriters that I have direct lines with that I can say, hey, you know, I have this guy, he's on this medication for this problem. What am I looking at? Right. And I think that all of these new medications are going to pose some problems in the next couple of years, just because we just don't know, you know, and to your point, some of them we do, right? I mean, Plaquenil, very different than the newer things coming up the pike, but they just don't know what to do with these meds. And, you know, I try to shout from the mountaintops that, you know, we have to get this stuff in place as young and as healthy as we can. We're also finding a lot of young residents have already gotten a bunch of diagnoses when they were younger, right? I just feel like the population as a whole, or maybe it's just the population I'm dealing with, seems to be getting sicker. Or we're just diagnosing things more, or maybe over-diagnosing some things. Dare I say it?
It's all of the above. It's all of the above. You know,
I agree. Even over-diagnosing, we've seen that affect our own family with things.
Yeah, it's
and then it's in your medical record and expunge it.
Yeah, it's all of the above. And so what I'm hearing, though, is I'm hearing not a salesman. I'm hearing a consumer advocate.
Well, thank you. That's what I like to consider myself. I mean, I really don't consider myself a salesperson. I am considering myself an educator and an advocate. That's the word I'm looking for.
Advocate. Yes. Yeah, there you go.
I'm like, advocator? That's a weird word.
I don't think that's a word.
An advocate. And, you know, I'm talking about, yes, I am talking about something that people should be buying, right?
Right.
But it's not a one size fits all either, right? Each of these policies has nuances that make them unique. And what's good for you isn't necessarily what's good for your partner. It's maybe not what's good for your best friend. And without that education, again, I go back to, we just don't know what we don't know. And, you know, I want people, my goal is to make insurance purchasing as close to informed consent as I can make it.
I have a question about some conditions. So for instance, I guess the first one that pops in my head is migraine, because it's very difficult. Some states cover it, some don't. Most people, some people have a family history. Some people have started to experience it, you know, when they're 12, 13, et cetera. Can and do people ever get disability insurance to cover for migraine, or the fact that they're going to be missing a lot of work? Do most insurances just say, sorry, too bad? I'm curious, because I've had a bunch of patients that have gotten on long-term disability for it from the state and some not. And so I thought, what the heck? I'm going to ask, because that's been me all my life. But
so you're not going to love my answer, because it depends.
Right.
Is the short answer. I have found historically that it is easier for lesser educated, lower socioeconomic households mm-hmm. to qualify for state-led disability or government-led disability, because a lot of them are a function of what are you able to do. Physicians tend to be overeducated and overskilled. It's really hard for us to qualify for any of that stuff. Taking a step over as far as what disability insurance carriers will and won't cover depends on what's in your medical records. Mm-hmm. It depends on, you know, what have you complained about? Have you missed work? What are the treatment options that you've had, right? There's a big difference between somebody saying that they suffer migraines once a year, right? Versus the person who says, I have migraines, I get about 10 a month, I'm getting Botox, I'm on sumatriptan, Imitrex, Maxalt, right? Like you name it. They're going to decide what they are and are not covering based on that global information. So, you know, I have people that suffer infrequently who they've gotten covered. And I've had people that suffer a lot or have lost work or, you know, whatever, where the carriers will cover you as a person, but they're excluding a disability from a headache, right? Most issues cause an exclusion on coverage. So we'll still cover you, but we're not going to cover you for that.
Right.
There are certain disease processes where they do say, look, it's a risk that we're not willing to take. So for instance, type 1 diabetics, we really can't get traditional houses to cover. We tend to have to look at the non-traditional carriers. And those are the people that I'm like, look, you need to get a good group, you know, benefit or have one. And if it's not part of your package, that's one of your negotiators, right? Rheumatoid psoriatic arthritis, polyarthralgias, you know, issues where somewhere in the HPI, it says, you know, causing difficulty with work, right? Like right. We also, you know, you mentioned stuff being in our medical records. EMR has become one of the banes of my existence.
Oh, I hate it.
I don't know if this is a real term, and I say it a lot, so I'll take the coinage, but I call it EMR sweep. So how many times have you gone into a doctor and the MA says, anything changed from last year? I don't know how we're supposed to remember what we said last year. I'm lucky if I can remember what I, you know, ate for dinner last night.
All the time.
Right. And so what ends up happening is you gave a positive review of systems a year ago. You forgot that you did so. The box doesn't get unchecked. And now it sweeps to all of your next visits. Medication changes. And I can use myself as an example. I was at the eye doctor this morning. I already told y'all. And the MA said, any changes since last year? And I said, hey, can I look over your shoulder? Because I don't remember what I said a year ago.
Right.
My meds have completely changed. Yeah. I've gotten a couple new diagnoses. I got a couple that were refuted. You know, I was at my gynecologist last year. My medical record said I had a hysterectomy. Guess what, guys? I still have my uterus. What? I make polyps. I've had 3 hysteroscopies, but an MA at some point checked off hysterectomy. I never thought to look, right?
Wow. Right. And because so, yeah, they misread it. They think hysteroscopy right. is a hysterectomy. It affects your medical record. You're right.
Right. You know, I have people that admitted to drug use in college. It never came off. It has literally been swept across for 10 years.
So the other name for that would be people that went to college.
Right. Right.
Right. But this the bullshit of these electronic medical records and the big user error in them.
Right.
And what happened?
Well, the one that freaks me out in the urgent care is asthma.
Oh.
Because for I cannot explain this, but I have seen people that they are, for whatever reason, there are certain viruses, and this year has blown my mind, where people literally get an asthmatic response.
Well, they're just wheezing.
And they're in their 60s or 70s, and they're having a hyper, you know, an airways hyper response reaction. Well, if you're 10 and that happens to you,
oh, now you have asthma.
Now you have asthma. Maybe you don't have asthma, because it's happening to people that have had 50 years of no asthma. So then whoever sees them puts down reactive airways disease or asthma. You are never serving in the military. You're doomed.
Oh, like, there's
eczema. There's a difference between a dermatitis and true eczema.
Right.
Eczema, you're done for the military, because you can't get, it's an absolute contraindication to the smallpox vaccine. It is unbelievable how you can go to one urgent care in another state and have your records completely branded that can totally alter your life.
Yeah. I mean, I talk about this when I talk to residents, because I'm like, look, there's two sides of the story too. We also have to do a better job, in my opinion, as practitioners. Not everything somebody says needs to be in their HPI. It doesn't. You know, now I don't know about you guys. I think we're around the same age. I was taught you put everything they say, and it's in quotes, and whatever they say goes in the medical record. Well, guess what? I don't need to know in a 35-year-old that when you were 15 and an angsty teenager that you thought about dropping your Walkman in the bathtub.
Right.
First of all, they had batteries. It's not going to work. Right. Exactly. And tell me that you know a 15-year-old who at some point didn't hate their parents, didn't hate their life, and thought about going to sleep and not waking up. And I'm not making light of it. I have been truly suicidal. I am not making light of it.
Right.
What I'm saying is your care management at 32, that one episode is not changing any way that I look at you, think about you, or I'm going to treat you. Right. And we have to do a better job at protecting our patients. You know, these are things that come back and bite people in the ass when they're trying to get disability insurance and life insurance. And it takes a really long time to try to get medical records addended in the EMR space, because there's also potential billing fraud that gets attached to it, because if certain things have swept and, you know, it's getting coded as such, and payments are related to codes and time spent, physicians are a little bit remiss to going in and addending these records, because they might be putting themselves at risk. I mean, it's a much bigger conversation.
It is truly easier to file off George Washington's nose on Mount Rushmore with a nail file than it is to change an electronic medical record.
No kidding.
When I accidentally put the wrong data in the wrong chart, I literally have a panic attack.
Right.
Like, I'm just like, you know, because to try to, like, you have to go in there and you have to change it, and somebody reads it, and they don't
delete the addendum,
and you can't delete it. You can't, you know, you should be able to control alt delete it and then have it as a ghost in the background saying this was modified.
Right.
This is why it was modified.
I mean, I was able, thankfully, to advocate for one client, because literally it wasn't the client. It was a different gender. It was a different age. And, you know, it just said, you know, today I'm meeting with a 40-year-old blah, blah, blah male, and she was a 32-year-old female. But within that 40-year-old male's file, there were all sorts of diagnoses, and it was clearly the wrong person. But even that, it took us months to get that fixed.
And a lot of people, as we know, and we'll tell the story vaguely about what happened in our families, but if you don't get medical records or look at what the clinician's putting in there and say 10 years down the road, you need them, and you're like, what the heck is this? I remember that doctor was always 4 hours behind, and whatever they put in here, isn't a reflection of me. It's someone else's stuff. But now I'm just seeing it 10 years later. And how do you correct that when they've retired? I mean, it's just it's devastating. This is all about the importance of clarity in the medical record.
But it's also this is important for patients.
Yeah.
Like mm-hmm. I really want patients to understand this because they don't get to look behind the curtain and see the wizard of Oz.
No.
Right.
If you have any doubt at all, or if you're the least bit kind of anal about what's in your medical record, you can look at it every single time now.
I tell everyone when I do my lectures, the next time you are at any doctor's office, ask to look over their shoulder. And if you want, at the end of the visit, you can say either you want to get a copy of your records or you want to see it, right? Now, part of that problem is how many docs wait until after hours to finish their medical records, right? Or do it at home on their home computers. It's not the same as when we used to write them and it was in real time.
Right.
Right.
I think that's rapidly changing. I think that we are realistically, within the two year window where AI completely takes over documentation. I will be floored if it doesn't, because it's going to be better, faster, and way more accurate. And I would propose to patients, especially once this AI world comes in, they should leave with their medical record.
I tell people that too. I'm like, you should have all of your medical records on your drive somewhere, because at some point you're going to need them, whether it's because of insurance or because of a hospitalization, right? Or you're somewhere out of town. And, you know, I used to say this a lot when I was practicing with OB records, and I'm going back to when they were paper, that if somebody told me that they were going out of town, I would say, before you leave, make sure they photocopy your OB notes, because I don't like to be the OB when somebody comes in and I don't have any of their records.
Right.
And I would say, take it, keep it on you. Like, it's more important than your passport.
Yeah. I had mine. I remember that.
I just remember those days, because, you know, I was the country doctor and I would be on OB call, and they'd call me and they'd say, there's a couple here that are working at the local carnival mm-hmm. and they're going to back their van up to the door of the OB unit, and he's going to deliver the baby. And if there's any problems, they want to know if they can just come inside.
And then, what?
Uh-huh. Yes.
And I said, I'll tell you what, why don't we do this? Why don't we just bring them inside right now, and I'll come in and admit them, and then we'll deliver this baby and we'll have a nice conversation about the worst accidents he's ever seen on carnival rides, which is exactly what happened. I sat with the father for about an hour and a half, and he told me about the cotter pins coming out of the zipper and people being slammed into the ground.
Mm-hmm. But there's and a setup for a horrible delivery.
And then he said, can I deliver my baby?
Yeah. No. And then I delivered his baby. And then he said, hey, doc, this has been great. You've been great. Anytime we're in town, I can hook you up. And I was like, that sounds just something I will absolutely not do.
Hook you up on the zipper or in other ways?
Oh, on the zipper. or with the meth that's required to put the zipper together.
Put the zipper on? Yeah. But no, I mean, it's a real thing. So I push pretty hard on both sides of, you know, patients need to control what's in there. Physicians need to pay a little more attention to what they're writing.
Yes.
And if it really affects care or not.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want anyone to be fraudulent. Like I say it all the time. I'm okay being famous. I'm not okay being infamous. Right. Same thing. Like, I don't want people being fraudulent. I don't want people being sneaky and what have you. But we all know that there are times where things get written down that really don't affect patient care.
No.
Yeah, but that's the problem is too, though, is the EMR ties your handcuffs you at times. So, for instance, our son got allergy shots. So he was getting allergy shots 25, 30 miles away from the allergist's office because we lived in the country. So the tradition of the clinic was, is they wanted a certain number of EpiPens per lot of allergy shots for their patients generically. So they wanted to get it covered by insurance. So he got to be the lucky duck that got an EpiPen.
prescribed.
So then, well, you get into the EMR and you go, you can't write allergy shots. We're cheap bastards and we want the insurance company to pay for the EpiPen. That diagnosis doesn't exist even in ICD-10. So what do they put? They keep clicking till they find one that gets green.
Anaphylaxis.
Yep. So now you're anaphylactically allergic. Guess what? Guess what that does to you? Try to get insurance when you have anaphylaxis.
Oh, trust me. I know. I deal with that. Right. And I go back to it's insurance fraud.
Yes. So now we've gone literally because of things in his life and where he's gone. We had to get a note from the allergist stating he never had anaphylaxis. This was just to cover his shot. I mean, it's just ridiculous stuff.
No, I'll tell you, we had one of the more interesting for me, but not for the client story was, you know, I ask everybody, what medications are you taking? And oh, by the way, they look back 5 to 7 years and here are the red flag medications. Are any of these going to pop up? And infertility meds is one of the red flags. And she was like, no, I saw REI one time. I ended up getting spontaneously pregnant, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, all right, I might be able to argue that because it's spontaneous and whatever. I end up getting a nasty gram from the insurance carrier saying, I thought she only went once. Why are all these meds popping up? So I call and I'm like, hey, they're getting a hit on all of these meds. And she was like, Stephanie, I never took them. I never picked them up. And I was like, well, what the hell happened? Her practice to find out how expensive the drugs would be. Yeah.
Yes, they send in the prescription.
We're sending in the prescription so that they could tell patients what stuff would cost and didn't realize that this was now a hit against their patient. And it was the same thing. It took us a long time to get it redacted, to do it. And it's a nightmare because the insurance companies don't know if you pick up a medication or not. They don't know if you take it or not, right? I had another weird case where somebody called in a medication for their spouse that was really for their dog.
Yes.
Because it was cheaper.
Yes.
Get it for their human.
Mm-hmm.
And that partner got denied life insurance.
We've heard that. Oh, yeah. Prozac. They have people give Prozac and
Prozac. Actually, I'm not convinced Prozac works that well for most humans. I think it works for some. It works amazing for
dogs.
It works amazing for yellow Labrador retrievers that chew couches, though.
But it's really expensive.
Yes.
If you get it through your vet,
isn't that amazing?
But you know,
we hear this stuff. We've heard that exactly what you're talking about.
We were friends
exactly. But you're right. How it impacts in your ability to get disability insurance, life insurance down the road or whatever, you know, at the time you're like, whatever.
Right. You're just thinking, I'm going to save a few bucks. Who am I really hurting?
Or the point though, that man, I'm glad you brought that up because I remember this happened where we lived and worked. It was, you could not, people would ask, how much is it going to cost for this medication? And you call the pharmacy and the pharmacy would said, we don't know until it's in the system because it depends on their insurance. And so MAs would enter it in and then they'd say, okay, now I see it. It's this. So good. That's a really good
Well, and that's what people don't understand, which is another entire rabbit hole, but it's an important one. We've done one show on this and we may do another one. It's PBMs. And it's how, if you go to a pharmacy, you have no idea what something costs because the pharmacist doesn't have a clue because he is billing one of 60 PBMs in the United States, even though there's only four PBMs, I believe, that control about 90% of everything. And insurance companies aren't necessarily going to be on the same PBM
Correct.
When you renew your prescription. So the PBM, the pharmacy benefit manager, is the middleman cartel that controls the prices of all prescription drugs.
And that's fluid, whether it's on your formulary or not on your formulary. I had a medication a couple months ago that was on back order. And I'm like, look, I'll pay for brand. I don't care. It was $60, 60. This month, take a guess.
Oh, probably $500.
$1,000.
Wow.
And I said, wait a second. it cost me $60 last month. What happened?
It's a shortage. The labs burned down. I've heard that stuff before. That happened with the albuterol years ago. Mm-hmm. Some lab in India burnt down. The prices went up. Yeah.
I'm like, $1,000.
Yep.
We are sorry, but you will be very wheezy for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, seriously, it was like that. Yeah. The albuterol inhalers.
And needless to say, I have not had one of my medications this month because I was like, I just can't in good conscience spend $1,000 for a medication that was $60 a month before. And it's not a medication that's life-saving. So, okay.
Here we are.
Right.
Wow. Yeah,
I want to go down the rabbit hole. And if you know anything, you know what's coming of what in the future, get your crystal ball. Are you hearing anything from the insurance companies about the vaccines, COVID, what's happening for disability, et cetera?
They don't know what to do with COVID. I can at least give you some anecdotal stuff. I mean, they're keeping that information really tight to vest and it's proprietary. So I'm not going to know it till I know it.
Right.
I can tell you right now that people that have had a hospitalization due to COVID end up with what's called a health hold. So it's not quite a decline, but it's not coverage, right? They want to see them kind of out of the hospital, asymptomatic, going to work every day for about a year before we can even look back.
Wow.
There are some where if they've had a post-COVID cardiac issue, we're like 2 to 5 years out right now. I just had somebody who had, post-COVID myocarditis and it got better. But again, they just don't know what to do. And so, just having COVID is not a big deal. But if you've had COVID and it's been what they consider to be moderate or severe, which is, have you gone to the hospital? Did you have an overnight stay? Are you on long-term medications? Has anyone brought up the term long COVID? Long COVID, forget it. I can't get people traditional coverage. I have to go to the non-traditional carriers.
I think long COVID should be expunged from the vernacular because nobody knows what it is. There's no definition.
Exactly.
I mean, there's people like our friend in North Carolina who's a trauma surgeon who for months who's super fit for months as a 44-year-old healthy professional woman couldn't walk to the bathroom without desaturating into the 80s. That's long COVID.
Right.
Then there's people that have
fatigue
and brain fog and they fart 4 more times than usual. And you go, is that long COVID? Is it a other viral syndrome? Is it like, I don't know what it is.
And I'll tell you, so I've tested positive for COVID now 4 times. 3 of the times I got knocked on my ass. After this last one, I literally had trouble formulating a cohesive thought for a little while. It's gotten better, but I still have some brain fog issues. I still have word finding issues. But here's the question. Is it long COVID? Is it menopause? Is it a actual brain issue, right? So then I had to go down that rabbit hole. My brain got MRI'd. It's clean. So now what, right? And it's just a tincture of time. And it's probably a mixture of all of the above, right?
It reminds me of back college days and EBV and chronic fatigue. I mean, I had that for years. And you're right. What do you do?
It's just it's exactly the same thing. It's the 2020 version of CFS.
Right. So and I will tell you that chronic fatigue, none of the insurance carriers want to touch.
Right. But
fatigue in general, if it's in your medical records, and give me a 35-year-old resident who's not fatigued.
Right. I'm laughing. Right?
Or new doc.
Everybody. Exactly.
Don't use the word fatigue.
Right.
But that's a super good point because it's back to the when should you get disability insurance? You should get it when you are young and healthy.
And healthy. And women before the first time you try to get pregnant.
Yes.
Right. And get it before you do like me and add a way more bad habits to all of your bad habits. So when I was just windsurfing, I had no motorcycles, was not skydiving yet, et cetera, because that stuff's all going to be written.
Oh, at, they all ask about avocations. Mm-hmm. And to your point, I used to be an adrenaline junkie. My shoulder, I can't anymore. But yeah, you want to get it before you have enough money to have expensive, dangerous hobbies.
So I have a quick question, specifically going back to a lot of disability policies offered by group will say that they'll cover you except while if injured at work. What the heck is with that?
So that happened to me in fine print. My group didn't cover work-related injuries. Interestingly enough, 20 years ago, that was the exception to the rule. We are not only seeing more of that, and I'll explain why, but they're also adding, they're not covering work-related injuries or illnesses. And we've seen this since the start of COVID, which I think is a terribly slippery slope. I don't know how the hell we're supposed to prove where we contracted an illness from if it's debilitating, right?
Other than like a needle stick injury that gives you chronic hepatitis C, right?
Right, yeah. Right. The reason is financial. So money that comes from disability insurance, right, is the carrier. Money that comes from workman's comp is the state. Mm. So they get to save money, the employers get to save money on the disability policy that they are offering to their employees, mm-hmm, by putting that line in there, because the expectation is you'll qualify for workman's comp.
Okay.
Now, the interesting thing is it doesn't always happen.
No.
I initially got declined. They said, pardon me, that while an injury occurred, my frozen shoulder was idiopathic or my fault because I continued to work while I was injured, which I did at the behest of my first orthopedist. So I ended up having to sue the state of Pennsylvania, and workman's comp varies by state. And currently, many states don't even recognize a six-figure income. And I will tell you, at least in 2013, when I was applying to Pennsylvania, workman's comp maxed out at $3,500 a month.
Right. So what do you do? So what
exactly
do you do? So what's the option? What's the option?
You have to have disability insurance. Exactly.
There you go.
You have to have private disability insurance. It's the only way.
Yeah, it's the only way.
Yep.
So you're saying in these group policies, okay, this one just is literally making my already oversized head
explode.
Because
people think that. They're thinking, yeah, either they're going to get their work coverage or the workers' comp, but it's peanuts or not covered.
This doesn't make any sense to me. So you're telling me that in your group coverage, they're going to say any illness?
Some of them are saying it now. They're saying work-related injury or illness.
Yeah, but if you get pneumonia, I could have gotten pneumonia because some 90-year-old coughed in the air. I could have gotten pneumonia because I went to poker night at the country club.
This is my argument. I don't know how we are supposed to prove, short of a needle stick, how we're supposed to prove where we got sick.
Right.
Right. Now, the hope is, right, that most illnesses do not become debilitating, but there's going to be a couple, mm-hmm, or they wouldn't have written it into the language. Like, right, somebody somewhere has some actuarial data that they're going to say is proprietary, so I'll never get it, right? Somebody saw that as a cost-saving measure and built it into the policies.
Well, I'm thinking things like asbestosis, right? I guess thinking coal miners.
I don't know.
Those kind of occupations, those aren't medical.
Right.
But
as far as medical, I'm looking at medical stuff, right?
COVID.
I think it's COVID, right? They're seeing a lot of people with long COVID, with post-cardiac issues, where they really are cutting back on work. And they're getting... they have to pay these cases. And now they're going to say, you're a physician. Did you wear PPE every day? Did you do XYZ? And the second you say no, they're going to say you got it at work and we're not paying for it.
Yeah, and, which is entire horseshit. Because it was a pandemic and it's a respiratory virus.
Correct.
You could literally shove all the PPE up your rear and it wouldn't do anything because respiratory viruses are going to do whatever the hell they're going to do. That's why every single freaking person in the United States got COVID more than once because A, their vaccine didn't work, and B, PPE doesn't do a damn thing. So respiratory viruses are going to They're going to respirate everywhere. That's what they do.
And then we're seeing an increase in all the other viruses because people were wearing masks and weren't stuck at home and weren't getting exposed to all the things that we need to get exposed to build our immune systems. Exactly. So I see this as a really slippery slope, and it's really frustrating. They're also getting really creative at other things that they're putting limits on. There's a whole new, going back to your headaches, called subjective illnesses,
right,
that they're limiting to a 2-year benefit. And it's including, but not limited to, headaches, fatigue, pain, even repetitive motion issues, where maybe there's not a pathognomonic test, right? Not everybody that has migraines has a positive head scan, right? But we know that it's real, right? And so they're saying, we're only going to cover that for 2 years. More scary is they're limiting musculoskeletal stuff to 2 years. And this is not every policy, but I'm starting to see it more and more. And that's the number one reason that physicians leave practice. So the bigger,
like, especially issue, orthopedists, people that are doing
all the proceduralists.
You get your right eye shot out with a Red Ryder BB gun. You can't do brain surgery anymore because you have no depth perception.
No, I
mean, you can do brain surgery, just very poorly.
No, but if you're at work and you're doing hip replacements, or you're
incredibly physical.
Cleaning out joints all the time. I mean, it's hard on your own joints. Yeah.
I think about all the times where, you're sitting on a stool and your body's like this, or you're doing all the things and you're holding up body parts and you're helping to move patients and, primary care who help their elderly folks up on the tables, right? Neck, shoulder, back, get shot. We're just not made, right, to do all the things that we do. I saw a study not too long ago, maybe a year and a half ago, that linked physicians and construction workers. And we have almost the same disability numbers. And it kind of makes sense. We don't really think about it, but there is a lot of physicality to what physicians do. And a lot of us kind of take it for granted or kind of forget about it. And it's a really big deal. And the bigger issue, and part of why I really want people to get coverage when they're in training, is that when you become an attending, the game changes as to how much benefit you qualify for. So one of the things I say not infrequently, I'm in a really interesting sales space. I don't control the product. I don't control the cost. I don't control how much I can get you. I control education, advocacy, and service. You can't say to me, I want $20,000 a month in coverage. I'm willing to pay for it. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
Once you're out of training, the carriers look at how much money do you make? What benefits do you get from your employer and who pays for them? And they give you a number.
Wow.
It is not uncommon, specifically for primary care, to qualify for less as an attending than they would have as a resident or a new attending.
If you have nothing already, then you're going to qualify maybe for more versus you start a job and you've got this group policy.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So in training, they don't care. They don't look at your income. They don't look at your hospital benefits because they know you're in transit. Every resident qualifies for a $5,000 a month benefit. Now, two of the carriers have gone up just a little bit. I'm trying to keep it apples to apples. There's also a gray zone when you are within 6 months of graduating training and 6 months to 2 years, depending on the carrier, where you qualify for what's called starting practice limits or new something, something limits, where they'll give you $7,500 without looking at your income or your benefits. I had to tell a OB anesthesiologist this very morning, who's making almost $400,000 a year, that she qualifies for less than $2,000 in private coverage because of the way that their group benefit is structured. And sometimes these robust benefits hurt us. Her policy had a maximum benefit of $35,000 a month, but it had shitty language, but she can't opt out of it. Right? Jeez. And so there are, beyond the you're young and healthy, it's that you can actually capture more. I learned that the hard way too. I didn't get it as a resident. I didn't know about it. My first year as an attending, I qualified for $3,800 a month of benefit. And had I gotten it literally 6 months earlier, I could have gotten $7,500. Like, that's insane.
Wow.
But no, that's
I am literally captivated. Like,
Stephanie, I know you do lots of education. So tell us, like, do you go in to the residents of med schools locally? Do you do Zoom meetings for others? Do you stick to your state?
All of the above. So Nothing makes me happier than educating trainees. I lecture in person. I lecture Zoom. I've been all over the country. I don't cold call people. So all of my lectures have been organic. Either, you know, I know somebody who knows somebody, because the issue that I run up against is the bureaucracy of hospitals, in that they don't want salespeople coming in anymore. And they just can't think past the fact that I'm not coming in as a salesperson. Again, yes, I am talking about something that people should be buying. We don't have the infrastructure to take care of a million docs. I want to know that I've played a part in educating and empowering physicians to ask the right questions. And when I come into hospitals, I'm speaking as Dr. Pearson. I put up a disclosure, you know, a disclosure slide or disclaimer that, yes, I am part owner of an insurance brokerage firm, but that's as far as I talk about my company. It is literally DI 101. I talk about different real scenarios so that people can put numbers to what I'm talking about. I talk about roadblocks, right? What are some of the behaviors that I'm seeing now? And it is purely educational. So anybody listening, if you want me to talk, I'm game. I love it, love it, love it. March, I am crazy busy. And it's making me very happy.
No, this awesome. Is great, because it's, you got to buy it early. Clearly, as a resident, makes the most sense. And it's not that expensive when you're young and healthy. And it is just...
Or you think you might be unhealthy because your bad family history, something's coming up, get it sooner.
Then maybe it's even more important. But I mean, you know, these pillars of finance, you know, estate planning, paying yourself first, and insurance. It's at least a three-legged stool.
Oh,
and
definitely.
None of those things are hard to understand. But, you know, we read The Wealthy Barber when we were in residency. It actually helped us out a lot.
That's a Canadian.
We would have been even stupider than we already were.
But yeah.
I read The Path to Something, right? The guy that wrote it for his daughter who started like one of the Vanguard things.
I've heard. I don't know the name of it, but
I can't think familiar. Of it now. But yeah, that was a book I read, you know, and I was like,
It's like The Millionaire Next Door, The Wealthy Barber.
Yeah, it's like one of those. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. You know, and again, it's not rocket science. Right. I mean, and I think that there is a misconception amongst physicians that all of this financial literacy stuff is complicated and they're not going to understand it. Like, you've gotten through med school and residency. Like, come on. Right. It's not rocket science, but you have to get the right information from the right person at the right time. And when we don't know what we don't know, it makes it a little bit tougher.
Absolutely true. So thanks for being here. This has been eye-opening. I hope that people reach out and get in touch with you, even if it just means doing having you do a Zoom. So tell them where they can find you. Easiest way to get in touch with you.
So our website is Pearson Ravitz. Hopefully you guys will spell that out. It's not rabbit like the animal. It's Ravitz with a V like Victor.
And funny enough, somebody did. One of our friends was just listening and thought that too. And then he read it. Yeah.
It's a common mistake.
Yes.
So PearsonRavitz.com. I am me on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. I believe my marketing team started a TikTok maybe this week, which is new to me. I am aging myself. I'm letting them run with it. I am, I think, more accessible now than I was when I was practicing. So please feel free to reach out to me any or all methods.
Absolutely. We'll link all of that. And I encourage the listeners to go back to on our podcast episode. It's 139, where you were on before and shared your whole story in more detail and that whole saga. And it's sad, but enlightening for people to listen to, because you always think, won't happen to me. I'm immune and stuff happens.
Listen, I talk about the tyranny of perfection in medicine, that we are kind of set up in a way to think that we are invincible and infallible, and not the case.
Nope. Nope, not at all.
Nope. What was the stat? Most people become disabled. I mean, for sure we will all die, but most people will become disabled in their working lifetime.
Yeah.
And, hopefully it's only short term, but for sure, but long term, that's devastating. So, all right, Stephanie.
Thanks.
Thanks again. It was awesome. And I don't know.
Love being with you guys. And I think I'm with you guys for one of the doc tales coming up.
Yes. I can't wait for that. I think we'll share some scenarios of crazy stuff we've seen, heard, and experienced.
Yeah. We want to play a game called Would You Cover That?
Yes.
Oh, sure. I love it.
Yeah,
I'll pat myself on the back. I am a pretty decent underwriter. I also know when to say when. So if I say I don't know, it's because I really don't know.
And some of them I think will probably be so obvious. we'll just be laughing at the stupidity.
We're going to try to find actual scenarios that we know are true. We'll save the turkey baster for that one.
Yeah. Dude, I'm in.
Let's not talk about the turkey baster till then. Okay.
All right.
All right. Back on, guys. Thanks for having me.
As always, I love talking to Stephanie and learning so much about disability, life, insurance, all the things. And this was really good. It built upon the previous episode. If you haven't listened to 139 with her and her story, and we get into the nitty gritty of the difference between the types of insurance policies. If you're a newbie to it or you need a refresher, go listen to that one. The other thing I was going to say is we were actually having a conversation after the recording was done, and she brought up some other really good points that I want to mention that I wish we had it recorded. But we were talking about things for the future and looking, you know, at getting yourself covered before you get sick. And in this day and age, not just all the biologics and conditions, but all the genetic testing that's coming out, people are, you know, you can do your gene testing for like different types of cancers, BRCA gene, HERS2 gene, genetics for musculoskeletal conditions in the family, or specifically the cancers now in women to know. Well, if you get that done and it's on your record as you being a carrier or having a positive genetic mutation that can drastically impact your health in the future, you are screwed sometimes when it comes to getting a policy. So think twice before you start doing things that are permanently on your record. So that was some tidbit that I wanted to add, because that was another really good point. It can drastically affect your coverage. Anything to add, Tim?
Guard your medical records with your life. I mean, I used to get all upset about the fact that, you know, patients had unlimited access to records and, you know, they were going to get upset because we called them fat when really you just need to look in the mirror.
You know,
all of that stuff, and guard those records, because if stuff is, if stuff is not correct in them, the chance to get them corrected is right away. There's almost zero chance later.
Oh, and the other thing, did we talk about this on the show about the, you know, things like 23andMe and looking at your family tree and swabbing your DNA and sending it off to some third party can backfire in a big, bad friggin' hurry.
Well, who knows how, who knows when AI gets a hold of that stuff? I don't even want to think about it. So
all things to think about when you start going down those trails. So check out her website, which is PearsonRavitz.com. That is Pearson with a P-E-A-R-S-O-N. And Ravitz is R-A-V-I-T-Z or Z if you're Canadian. PearsonRavitz.com to get more information, to get her to come speak to your organization, group, Zoom. Is the way to go. So, well, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Obviously, if you have any questions, send them to us at our email at doc@bs3md.com. And today's shout out goes to the one and only sister of mine, Heather Burgess. You recently reached out in response to one of our newsletters, and that blew my mind away that you actually wrote a formal reply. Thanks for letting me know that you loved it and that it meant something to you. I guess I can even touch family members. So,
well, it's the one that I wrote.
Oh, it was. I forgot. Okay, well then, I take that back.
Then never mind.
You liked his and not mine. Well, she probably is not even listening to this. Anybody else, please send us your comments, questions, not concerns. No, I'm kidding. And rate and review us, please. Because that really helps us get the show out. And honestly, we're having a contest. By the time this episode airs, it's probably over. But you can always give us a 5-star review and write a comment because it helps our podcast out. All right, everybody, enough of that. We will see you all next time.
It's no secret that medicine is a bit uptight. That's why Tim and I created BS Free MD. To mix things up a little and have fun in the process. Besides, we are having these exact same discussions all the time, so we thought we might as well invite everyone to the party. If you really like us, you can get plenty more and maybe see one of Tim's cool tattoos on our Instagram or Facebook pages at BS4MD. See you next time.
While we try to keep BS3MD as raw and real as possible, we can't be held responsible for any medical decisions or discussions had as a result of what you've heard on the show. We know, bummer. But the truth is, we really do care about your questions. So feel free to reach out to us by email at doc@bs3md.com.